Okay, good afternoon, everyone. We're going to continue our agenda with highly migratory species reports. We are going to break in time for the council briefing on the National Policy for Recreational Fishing. It's scheduled to start at 5:30, so we will be concluding our business before then. Just to provide a brief overview before Mike and Dave brief us, the New England Council has a seat on the ICAT advisory panel. We are going to be asked to provide some guidance and advice at the September meeting for an October meeting. So the information that Dave and Mike are about to provide us is to some background prior to that. So, Mike, you're going to tee us off?
Yes, thank you. Basically, I'm going to be reporting on the Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel meeting. There are two meetings a year, one in the spring and one in the fall, and I attended the spring meeting on 3-4 April in Silver Spring. You can see from this picture that these meetings just generate all sorts of excitement. They actually do, but may not show in that photo. So just to explain the structure here, first, highly migratory species broadly refers to tunas, large sharks, basically all sharks other than dogfish, as far as I can tell, swordfish, billfish like marlin, and sailfish. So it's a high charisma collection of species. And these are both commercial and recreational fisheries. Some species are predominantly recreational, such as the marlins. Things like swordfish are predominantly commercial. They're domestic and international. That is, the U.S. industry is involved, as well as for most of these, there's an offshore international fishery. And these species are either directly or indirectly managed at the international level by the International Commission for Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, or ICAT. And in order to advise that process, there's a group called ICAT Advisors, which is actually the group that Dave is going to be reported on. But to make the distinction, there's also domestic management by the National Marine Fisheries Service Highly Migratory Species Division, which sits in Silver Spring. It's sometimes referred to as the Ninth Council. At one time, many of these species were managed under the council system with shared management plans between, in the case of swordfish, for example, all of the councils in the Atlantic. After some period of time, that was determined to be unworkable, and the law was changed such that essentially this Highly Migratory Species Division was set up in NIMS headquarters to look off after Atlantic highly migratory species, and basically to fulfill the obligations that the U.S. takes on as a result of ICAT, as well as other domestic obligations that don't necessarily stem from ICAT. So the domestic program is, as mentioned, under the Highly Migratory Species Division in the agency's headquarters, and it has an advisory body called the HMS, or Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel. So there are two different bodies that actually provide stakeholder input into the process, one aimed at the domestic implementation and the other at the development of policy at the international level. So I'm reporting on the domestic side of it. Dave will be reporting on the international. The science from these comes from, in the international setting, exclusively from SCRS, the Scientific and Statistical Committee of ICAT. Domestically, both science from SCRS and from the CEDAR process, which is the Southeast, what does CEDAR stand for? Southeast Data Assessment and Review Process. So that's the background on what's going on here. In terms of the April meeting of the advisory panel, I'll highlight three issues, the first three bullets, one dealing with shark conservation, second one with management of bluefin tuna, particularly the bycatch issue in the longline fishery. Some comments that were made about the implications of the North New England Fishery Management Council's Omnibus Habitat Amendment. And then the fourth bullet there, I just want to raise a general point about the role of people who sit on these sort of panels on behalf of the council, and just put that on the table for some consideration. So let me go through these points pretty quickly. Shark conservation. I don't think there's a lot of...
It's not up on the screen.
Oop, I'm pushing the wrong button. Sorry, folks, I'm pushing my computer button instead of that one. Shut that down. So, okay. So these are the four points I mentioned, and thanks, Dave, for pointing that out to me. The four points I mentioned, and then, so let's talk about shark conservation. I don't think there's a huge amount of direct impact on New England fisheries of the various shark conservation activities at this time, but they are important, and I'm sure that council members care about them. So the advice on sharks is generated both by SCRS, which has a group that does assessments on sharks at more or less a regular basis. And there's also some CEDAR advice, in particular, most recently, a CEDAR assessment that dealt with dusky sharks, which is driving some of the current management thinking. The Highly Migratory Species Division put together Amendment 5 to deal with shark conservation, and along the way, the amendment got essentially separated into Amendment 5A and 5B. 5A has now been put in place, effective July 2013, about a year ago, and it has a variety of new conservation measures for sandbar sharks, scalloped hammerhead sharks, black-tipped sharks, and black-nosed sharks. It also has various new initiatives that deal with shark tournaments, essentially reducing the kill of sharks in shark tournaments. And this does have a significant impact on particularly the recreational sector that participates in shark tournaments. Amendment 5, dealing with dusky sharks, the issue of conservation of dusky sharks turned out to be much more controversial and difficult, and therefore it was broken off as a separate amendment referred to as Amendment 5B, and a pre-draft was issued in March 2014, so very recently. Basically, dusky sharks, according to the CEDAR, are overfished, and overfishing is occurring, and the amendment is essentially attempting to put in place a rebuilding plan with a 70% probability of rebuilding dusky sharks in, I don't remember the exact time period, but some reasonable time period given their life history. It's more than 10 years, but still not more than a couple of decades. This is still in the review and debate stage at this point, but I presume that something will eventually happen to deal with the rebuilding requirements on dusky sharks. I'll just mention a couple of other things about sharks. They are popular for Endangered Species Act listing petitions. Right now, I think there are, I've listed three of them up there. So there are three petitions that are active. Some of them are in the initial stages of review. Others are overdue for a report in terms of what the agency will do with the petitions. One of them is dusky sharks, which would certainly be a reason to move forward with the management plan for rebuilding as in the context of addressing the ESA issue with dusky sharks. I also want to mention that sharks are a popular species for consideration by CITES, which is the Convention for International Trade in Endangered Species. And there are several species listed as CITES Appendix 2, which basically requires that any country participating in international trade of those species maintain good records and report on international trade. The U.S. Virtually has no international trade in any of these species, so it's not really an issue for the U.S. in terms of a workload issue of reporting, but it is important to many interests in the U.S. that this be that the CITES requirements be maintained. So those are my comments on shark conservation. Second issue, which is much more of a high profile to the New England fishing industry, fishing community, both recreational and commercial, would be Western Bluefin Tuna Management. And there's been a rebuilding plan for Western Bluefin Tuna since 1998, I believe. There's been management. It was some of the first serious management by ICAT that dates back to about 1981 or 82. 98, the rebuilding plan went in place, and it's still in place with various issues concerning the status of the stock because of some unknown elements of the population dynamic models. That's not directly important in what I'm going to discuss in terms of domestic implementation, because all that plays out in the international debate that Dave will talk about in terms of what the TAC is at the international level. From the domestic perspective, there's a TAC at the international level and there's a U.S. allocation. And the U.S. then has to put that in place and manage within it, and it does include discards. The U.S. Distributes its domestic allocation into seven categories, a recreational category and several different commercial categories, including the pelagic longline fishery, which is not targeting bluefin tuna. It's targeting swordfish and other tuna, but not bluefin. But it does catch bluefin, and it does have an allocation of bycatch to cover its bycatch. And in recent years, it's exceeded that allocation and, in fact, had to discard, which obviously no one wants to see bluefin tuna discarded. So this recent proposed draft amendment 7 is aimed at the discarding problem in the pelagic longline fishery, discarding of bluefin tuna. And it effectively, let's see. It basically addresses this by, number one, reallocating quota to the pelagic longline fishery to cover its bycatch. Not all of it. There will still be pressure on the pelagic longliners to reduce their overall take of bluefin tuna, but they would get some increase to cover some of it. The implication of that is that there's a permanent decrease in quota to all the other categories. Until this year, and in fact until this amendment is approved, the way these overages have been covered in the pelagic longline fishery is by reallocating within year of unused quota. And so far in recent years, there's been enough unused quota so that the U.S. is able to adhere to its overall quota. This proposal is one of permanent reallocation and essentially internalizing the bycatch problem of the pelagic longline fishery to that fishery. They've now got to figure out how to live within their means, so to speak. And part of the approach to achieving that is basically an ITQ. It's called an individual bluefin quota scheme, which would then allow each individual operator to deal with his or her own allocation of bluefin tuna and figure out how to live within it. To go with that, to make it a viable program, there also needs to be some sort of ability to monitor what's caught for every boat at the individual boat level, and so the proposal includes an electronic monitoring proposal, which seems, in my view, and this is only my view or my opinion, to be reasonably feasible in the case of something like bluefin tuna. Electronic monitoring is not the end-all to solve all problems, but when you're dealing with this fishery, a longline fishery and bluefin tuna, it seems like a reasonably achievable outcome. I put in red, this is controversial, and part of the controversy clearly is the permanent reallocation of quota from both other commercial sectors as well as recreational sectors. It's not a huge amount, but it is some quota, and every bluefin tuna is worth a lot to somebody. There's no question about that. I also think it's an interesting precedent that one should consider about both reallocating and establishing valuable ITQs simultaneously. It's one thing to allow to set up ITQs based on historical shares and then allow the reallocation process to take place through the market. But to reallocate and essentially provide something that's worth a lot without that market process, without it being a historical share, seems to me to be an important precedent that should be carefully considered. I'm not viewing what the outcome should be, but it's not the normal situation. So that's the bluefin tuna issue, which, as I say, the end is not clear as to when it will occur, when Amendment 7 will actually be acted on. Another minor point is that some of the participants in the advisory committee raised concern that this council's omnibus habitat amendment might in fact interfere with the ability to use hand gear, basically rod and reel, in the Stellwagen Bank area. And this came up in the meeting. Since the meeting, the executive director has clarified that is not what's in our preferred alternative. And as far as I know, this has put the situation to rest for now. But clearly, there's a lot of angst in the highly migratory species community about restrictions, and particularly, probably more so, concerns about the Stellwagen Marine Sanctuary Program than the New England Council's role in this. But in any case, the issue has been addressed by Tom to the point where I don't think there's any further consideration or action ongoing. So those are the things that I thought were worth reporting on. Let me go to one last slide, and this is something that occurred to me as I was participating in the meeting. This is the first time I represented the council in this forum, although I'd been to dozens of them wearing a National Marine Fisheries Service hat, but it's a little different when you're wearing somebody else's hat. And it struck me that there were three different roles I might play sitting at that table. One is one that's obvious, and I'm sure everyone would agree with. We want to make sure that whatever comes out of the highly migratory species process is well informed by whatever's happening at this council, and if there are things that need to be coordinated to avoid conflicts or just doing stupid things that don't work between the two entities, that there is the opportunity to do that. So I take that as a given. I can't see anyone would disagree with the need for coordination, given that these fisheries are taking place in the together in New England. Second is simply the highly migratory species advisory panel is made up of a lot of people that have experience and expertise, and the New England Council's representative could simply be adding to the strength of the panel overall, playing an honest broker's role on whatever the issues are. I think that's a very appropriate thing as well, although it does imply that there's trust in whoever that person might be, that they have that capability. The third role is the one that I think we need to think more about, and that is essentially go to this committee or this panel that's dealing with a large group of stakeholders and interests from all directions, and essentially be an advocate for New England, or New England fishermen in particular. And I raise that because prior to the panel meeting, we did have stakeholder presentations at our council meeting, which was essentially asking us to consider that sort of role as an advocate for a segment in the New England industry. In that case, it was more for the general category bluefin tuna industry. And I mention that because, in essence, that means choosing a view relative to a pelagic longline industry, which also exists in New England, although it has broader participation throughout the Atlantic states. So I'm not necessarily looking for an answer right now, but I think this is a broad issue that one needs to consider when we send people to represent a council. If it's role three, where there are multiple perspectives and maybe even disagreements or conflicts between the views within New England, then it does require that the council invest a substantial amount of time in developing positions for those things in advance. In this particular case, I made comments on it after some correspondence with the chairman that I felt were more in the camp of bullet two, being the honest broker, but other roles could have been played. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Questions? PK?
Yeah, Mike, you don't have to go into much detail, but how are the How do they arrive at the discard rates for the tuna for the U.S. TAC? And then are the discards accounted for in other TACs for other countries?
Well, the U.S. discards are that are reported to ICAT and taken account of in TAC are primarily from the longline fishery. And that's because the longline fishery has reasonable observer coverage. The observer coverage is actually driven primarily by the ESA requirements dealing with the biological opinion on turtles. But nevertheless, because of this coverage, the U.S. longline fleet probably has pretty good estimates of what the discards are. Now, there's a historical problem on this, and it may be a lesson to people who fill out logbooks. Historically, the U.S. allocation was based on what the U.S. reported in logbooks. And so we got some allocation of, I'll make up a number, 25 tons. And then we began to develop the estimates from scientific observer programs and found out that we were really discarding three times as much. And the result of that was there was a very serious problem of a mismatch at the international level between what scientifically we were estimating was being discarded versus our allocation that had occurred based on logbook reports. And in fact, frankly, it took many years of convoluted negotiations to straighten that out. But basically, the U.S. discards are based on scientific observer programs. Other countries are now increasingly supposed to report discards. I was recently in a meeting in Canada last week dealing with this same sort of issue on some other species. And so Canada is certainly trying to adhere, but it varies quite considerably as to whether there is reporting or not of discards that's reliable between countries. Thank you.
Other questions for Mike? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you representing the council in this new arena for us. Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mike. This is very gratifying to me because over the years, we have never addressed both levels, and it's to me, it's very pleasing to see that happen. The HMS division operates under the Atlantic Tunas Convention Act, which was put in place in order to require the United States, as a signatory to ICAT, to abide by ICAT's findings, and so that gives the HMS division the legal clout it needs in order to fulfill its mandate. ICAT is a totally different level. ICAT consists of 50 nations, or close to 50. So close to 50 now, probably going to reach 50 shortly. And they manage over 30 species in the entire Atlantic, of which really only two are directly important to New England. One is the western bluefin tuna, and the other one is the North Atlantic swordfish, and both of them are very important to New England. The New England effort consists of a United States delegation, which goes every year to the annual commission meeting in November, where all of the questions involving all of these species are hashed out. The U.S. delegation is supported by the ICAT Advisory Committee, or IAC, and the council has, off and on over the years, has been sending one person to represent the council. And in general, based on that last slide that Mike put up there, in general, what we've done is we've operated at number two of the three that you goals that you put up there. The IAC meets twice a year in order to formulate its direct input to the delegation. And New England has a permanent and rather important seat on that group. In addition to that, at the November Commission meeting, New England Council sends, or is supposed to send, one member as a member of the U.S. delegation once every 5 years. On that basis, I went to Paris at the 2010 meeting, which, because we had important New England issues at that time, we had made a switch with the South Atlantic Council, so that was actually our 2011. We will be sending somebody from this council in 2016. The issues were important to us in 2010 And once again in 2016, we have a series of issues coming up that are also going to be vital to the interests of New England, so it's going to be important that somebody from the council make that trip. The IAC meetings occur in the spring and in the fall. At the spring meeting, we get updates on the latest science and the latest management goals and break up into species working groups. The species working groups at this point begin setting the goals, or they actually at that meeting they set the goals by species and by species groups. Now I've included with the materials for this meeting a report on ICAT in general and our input to ICAT, and also I've added as an addendum two of the species working groups from the meeting this spring, May 1st and 2nd, one being the report of the bluefin tuna working group and one being the report of the swordfish species working group. These meetings were very successful for a number of reasons, and we have a number of goals listed in these, and you have copies of those now. At the fall meeting, that's when we take all of this stuff, plus everything that's happened over the summertime, and formulate actual policy that will guide the U.S. delegation at the full ICAT meeting in November, and that's how it works. One difference that I found between the two levels of management over the years that I've been doing the ICAT part of it is that in the domestic fisheries, the TAC is looked upon as being an upper limit. That's where you have one nation and one TAC. In the international domain, the TAC is looked at somewhat differently. It's looked at as a goal, or I'm sorry, as a target. We look upon it as an upper limit. In the international species, they look upon it as a target. That's important in our negotiations, because what happens if in a situation such as the United States finds itself in right now with swordfish, if for reasons that I'll get into in a few minutes, if we aren't catching our TAC, there will be a concerted effort by consortia of other countries to take it away from us. And that's one issue that we're going to have to deal with this November, and I expect to have some motions to place before this council at the September meeting in order to guide the policy to allow that to happen. The council action for this meeting right now today, we have no specific action right now, but we will have, as I said, a slate of potential motions in September to hash over and decide what this council's policy is going to be in providing guidance to the U.S. delegation in the November meeting, which this year is in Italy, by the way. Looking at the two species, the first one is the bluefin tuna. And as Mike mentioned, in 1998, ICAT began a rebuilding program to return the western bluefin tuna to MSY in 20 years through TAC adjustments. The reason for that was because the bluefin tuna, the western Atlantic bluefin tuna, experienced a collapse during the late 1970s. But that collapse was preceded by a collapse in recruitment that was really centered around the year 1974, in which there was a really almost precipitous drop in the recruitment. And this led to a real problem in deciding how to manage bluefin from that point on. What is it we're trying to, what are the goals? We couldn't determine the goals. And it, since the goals, the key factor in estimating these kinds of goals is the highest level of recruitment that can be achieved, we needed to know what the recruitment was. And something unusual had happened. The 1974 recruitment crash never started to trend back up as bluefin began to recover. So it became evident that somehow we had crossed a threshold and that for whatever reason, the recruitment was now at what appeared to be a permanently low level. And that led to two hypotheses that we've had arguments over for the last 20 years. One hypothesis is called a low recruitment scenario. Low recruitment scenario says that future recruitment is expected to remain near the present levels even if the stock size increases. At some point, there may be a jump back up. But what had happened was what the low recruitment scenario is based on is the idea that the 74 crash in recruitment led to a lower equilibrium for recruitment, and that we didn't have any real idea how to get past it. In 16 years, we still don't have an idea. I'd like to have you look at page 3 of my report on the Western Atlantic bluefin tuna summary. Our statistics on bluefin tuna are always listed in two columns, and we've never resolved the two columns. The first column is what we call a low potential, where we have a permanently reduced recruitment. The second one is called a high potential, where the recruitment goes back to something approximating what it was in the 60s and 70s. And we have never decided which one represents reality. For that reason, bluefin tuna management has been a constant battle between these two camps. Under the low recruitment scenario, MSY would be at 2,634 roughly, between 2,400 and 2,800 metric tons per year. If we could somehow make that jump back to the high recruitment level, we'd have a potential for perhaps a 6,400 metric ton take of bluefin tuna. These are not even close. In the low potential scenario, if that turns out to be true, then we are not overfishing bluefin tuna right now and overfished. They're not overfished, and we are not overfishing. If the high potential is correct, then we are overfishing by a considerable amount, and the species remains overfished. These two are mutually exclusive, and we've had battles over the years to try to determine which way we should manage. What we've done is, since 2010, we've maintained a very low western attack of 1,750 metric tons. Now we're in a position where we may be able to resolve these issues. Some new research has been reported on, and I'll have more information on it in September, that we may now finally be able to settle the one factor that we've never been able to determine, and that is what the effect is of migration from the western, the eastern stock and the Mediterranean stock. Migration has been the one factor that may have governed the entire biology of bluefin tuna. And now for the first time we are in a position where we may be able to actually identify what the correct action is. What this research revolves around is the residual chemicals from agricultural runoff that find their way into bluefin tuna tissues. And what they've been able to do is to take the otoliths from tuna and identify exactly when in the rings of the otoliths these chemicals are laid down. So in other words, if a tuna migrates from the Atlantic, from the Western Atlantic to the Eastern Atlantic, it brings with it markers of the runoff of the water that it was in. When it gets to the Mediterranean, it now begins to get runoff that's specific to the Mediterranean waters. If it migrates back, then it reverses that role. And what's happening now is that we're able to identify when and how often the species or the young tuna are migrating back and forth. With that kind of information, we can clarify the migration of tuna and hopefully be able to work out the pattern the tuna move in and the pattern in which in which they spawn and in which the recruitment occurs. Okay, Atlantic swordfish. Atlantic swordfish is a much different problem. Atlantic swordfish virtually collapsed, about 15 years ago, and with it went the American fleet. And over the last decade or so, the fleet has begun to recover and now is recovering much faster. During the time when the fleet was depressed and the swordfish was recovering, the American catch was depressed, and we weren't catching our tack. If you look at the page 3, the Atlantic swordfish data, attack of 13,700 metric tons would have an 83% probability of maintaining the stock and fishing mortality at a level consistent with the convention objective over the next decade while maintaining nearly level biomass. Attacks up to 14,300 tons would still have a higher than 50% probability of maintaining the stock in a rebuilt condition by 2021, but would be expected to lead to greater biomass declines. The Atlantic swordfish is no longer overfishing, and overfishing is not occurring. It's stabilized, but the American fleet is only now beginning to catch up. If you look at the table at the bottom of page 4, you see that what's happened with the U.S. catch is that from 2006, when it hit its low, it's increased, almost doubled, to 2012. During those years, we had to fight very hard to maintain our quota, because we weren't taking it, and that's been one of the key elements in our battles at ICAT. On the last page, I have data on economics, and what we show here is the average ex-vessel price per pound for bluefin tuna, and also for swordfish, and total sales changes. As I said at the September meeting, I'm going to have several motions to clarify the council positions on bluefin tuna and particularly on northern swordfish policies to preserve the U.S. quota. And with that,
thank you, Dave. Questions for Dave? Seeing none, my request, Dave, would be that as you get ready to start thinking about your motions, that you send them in to.
Yep.
So we can include them.
Yep.
in the council mailings ahead of the September meeting. Okay, we're going to move on to our next agenda item. We need Mary Beth and Lori.
So I'll get started while Lori gets set up.